Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lori Wagner, a member of the club's LGBT forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. Rex Wagner is a journalist and a blogger who has reported on LGBT issues for 25 years in 300 plus publications in 38 countries. Cynthia Laird has been the news editor of the Bay Area Reporter since 1999. Prior to that, she worked for the Lassen Advocate. Sandeep Roy, host of New America Now, KALW, and he's also a commentator on the Morning Edition on NPR. He writes regularly for mainstream and ethnic media outlets in the U.S. and in India. Kathy Brooks is an Equality Camp activist and founder of the Other Than That Consulting. She works with emerging information technology markets. We're especially fortunate tonight to have Scott Schaefer as our moderator. Scott's the host of KQED Radio's Statewide California Report. He worked previously in journalism at KPFA, at KFBK, where he filed some of the first stories on the AIDS epidemic, and KOIT. His work in the political sphere has included being press secretary to former Mayor Art Agnos and Comptroller Gray Davis's chief of staff. I'd now like to turn the program over to him.
There we go. Thank you, Lori. And thanks to all of you for coming tonight. The gay marriage issue is obviously a very dynamic issue, as we've seen just in the last few weeks. Vermont and Iowa have joined Connecticut and Massachusetts as the only states offering gay marriage, or soon to be. And tomorrow, New York's governor is going to be offering legislation to legalize gay marriage in New York State. Here in California, of course, the state Supreme Court is considering the validity of Proposition 8, and we expect a ruling on that in the next 60 days or less. And, of course, this being California, there's already at least one, I think several ballot measures being circulated for signatures, one or more of which could end up on the ballot here in California. So with the November election as hindsight and the coming decision just before us, and future campaigns never too far away, it's a good time to sort of consider where we've been and where we're going with regard to this issue, and especially as it relates to LGBT media. So let me begin just by asking each of you a really basic question, and I'll begin with you, Cynthia. How do you see your role? How did you see your role in the Prop 8 campaign as journalists, activists, bloggers, whatever it may be in your case, the old media, as you and I are members of, I think.
Well, we had been preparing for this campaign since 2005, when the anti-gay groups threatened to put an initiative on the ballot in 2006, I believe, and they abandoned that effort after they didn't get enough signatures or whatever. So we knew something was coming, and obviously, we always had an editorial position in support of marriage equality, and although we always tried to get comments from the Yes on 8 side for our coverage, they wouldn't always get back to us, probably because we were LGBT media, but you know, we did make that effort and continue to make that effort. It was a very, very challenging election to cover, and I think looking back after everything happened, one of the things I would definitely do differently is not put so much emphasis and coverage on the public polls that were released during the campaign, the field polls and the Public Policy Institute of California. I think our coverage of them on the front pages when they were released kind of fed into the complacency in the community, and I don't really think a lot of people realized just what a dire situation the No on 8 campaign was in.
Just coming back, though, to the coverage of the campaign and the lead up to the campaign, did you see the BAR, the Bay Area Reporter, as a neutral observer, as an advocate of one side or another, as an ally of the No on 8 campaign? I mean, honestly, how did you see
it? I think
yourself?
We're an advocate of LGBT rights and marriage equality. I don't think we were certainly not there to prop up the No on 8 campaign and their any shortcomings they may have had.
Sandeep, what about you?
New American Media, where I work, is a consortium of ethnic media. And as a nonprofit organization, we did not take a position on the campaign itself. But we did work on this other campaign called Let California Ring. And that was basically about raising awareness of same-sex issues. And our role in that was to use it as a conversation opener in ethnic media. So we embarked on this campaign in August, which targeted Asian, Black, and Latino media. And we found these couples who were Asian, gay couples, Latino, lesbian couples, and had ads from them running in this media over 6 weeks as a way to show that this was an issue, that to bring the issue home to these different communities, because you often hear that this is a thing that does not affect our communities. That's a story you'll often hear. And this was to dispel that myth. And in that sense, it really was an eye-opener for many people in the community. There were people in local Spanish language media who came out as a result of this campaign to their colleagues. You know, a publisher in a Central Valley media talked about the possibility of his sister and her partner becoming spokespeople for this. So it was really groundbreaking for a lot of people. And we actually hosted a debate with both sides, all represented from Black, Asian, and church leaders or community leaders on the issue.
And to what extent were there publications in these different communities that didn't really want these stories to run?
Well, that is, I think, the really interesting thing, Scott. We approached about 191 publications across the state. Five refused to run the ads. And they cited various reasons from, religious things to personal beliefs to being nervous about what their readers or listeners might do. But everybody else ran the ad. And, after the campaign was over, much was made about support by African Americans for Proposition 8. But I remember we had a roundtable of ethnic media leaders in Fresno. We had one in San Francisco, one in LA, and one in Fresno. And the most venerable Black publisher in the state, Bill Lee from the Sacramento Observer, came down personally to lead that roundtable discussion.
Just to clarify, were the ads paid for?
The ads were paid for by the California Ring campaign, but then there were stories and articles that the media also ran as a result of the ads.
And did the quote-unquote mainstream media cover these forums that you did at all?
No, there wasn't that much coverage. I don't know. There might have been a little coverage of the debate that we did between both sides. But I think one of the things that did happen was because this campaign was in August earlier, so as to not coincide with the No on 8 or the actual right before the elections, a lot of media came to us, and this is when some of the more hard-hitting ads from the Yes on 8 started coming out, with Mayor Gavin Newsom and the teacher ads. And a lot of these media came to us then and said, do you guys have any other ads? Because they were being approached by the Yes on 8 side to run these ads, and they were really keen to run, some other countering voices. And, of course, by then, this campaign particularly was over.
Rex, tell us a little bit about what you do, just generally, and then how you saw your role as a blogger and a journalist, someone who's been involved in LGBT issues for many, many years in this campaign.
It's kind of a weird time in journalism. Historically, I've just been a news reporter. I followed the same rules that the Associated Press might follow when they write a news story. And that's been my role for years and years and years in basically being a kind of a small wire service that feeds articles into gay papers around the country. 300 or some over the years have picked up these articles that I write. The interesting thing that's happening is because of the internet, we're kind of moving into an era where I think it actually started when you started seeing New York Times reporters and Washington Post reporters on those Sunday morning chat shows on TV kind of expressing their opinions about things that they also wrote news about. So on the one hand, I still sit down and write a straight or a hard news story like I always have. But some years ago, my friend Andres put up a blog, and he said, you should put up a blog. And I was like, okay. So I put up a blog. You know, I put a picture of my dog on the blog or whatever. And as time went on, I just sort of couldn't resist sometimes putting my opinion out there. So it's kind of like when I sit down to write a news story, I have on one kind of hat, and when I sit down to do something on my blog, I feel like I put on another kind of hat. When Prop 8 came along, it put me in a very uncomfortable situation in one way, because I was covering it as a reporter, and I could clearly see that they were messing it up. And
The campaign,
yes,
the No on 8
the
campaign.
No on 8 was messing up. And I also have this mailing list that's got, like, I don't know, a couple thousand people on it. Some of the people in this room, like Mike or Dan, are on that list. And people started, you know, responding to my clipping list. You know, like, it's a list that says, hey, this ran in the Chronicle today. You might want to look at it. Click here. People started responding to some of the articles that I was putting out, forwarding about Prop 8, you know, complaining about what was going on in the No on 8 campaign. And I guess I sort of realized that I was in a position where I had been observing the California GLBT movement since I moved here in 1994, and I was kind of in as good a position as anybody to analyze if something was going right or something is going wrong. And one day I just finally put a post up there that said, I thought they were messing up. And that kind of became then, I mean, that kind of, these bigger bloggers like Joe Jervis at Joe My God and Andy Toll at Toll Road and Andrew Sullivan at The Atlantic, you know, grabbed my post and linked to them, and then I sort of became this voice of passing on less than positive information about maybe how the No on 8 campaign was being handled, even as I was still writing standard AP news stories about it for the front page of the newspaper. So
it's a different tone to those two things.
Completely different hat. I mean,
yeah.
I just sort of like, it's a dual personality almost.
Kathy, you're kind of the odd girl out here in a way.
One of these things is not like the other.
tell us a little bit about what you did with Equality Camp and what you were trying to accomplish in the context of the campaign and and how that worked out.
So first, I have to kind of hang my head because the Equality Camp stuff and my involvement in the movement happened after the election. So I'm one of those people who got involved late, and I know, Michael, shake your finger at me, you're absolutely right. And it got personal for me and for a number of my friends after the election because we had worked hard in the last months and we lost and we were upset about that. And all of us, when I say us, it was myself and four others, a woman by the name of Tara Hunt, another woman named Heather Gold, who's a stand-up comedian, Adina Levin, who works at a company called Social Text, and a consultant by the name of Hillary Hartley. And we all got together and started talking about how one of the problems in the campaign, of which there were many, was the disenfranchisement of the community itself, and that the community had no way to connect. And what Obama showed us through the last 18 months before that was how technology could be used in an incredibly powerful way to democratize a movement, blending a top-down, old-school infrastructure movement with a grassroots, bottom-up, give everybody a way to get involved in a way that is comfortable for them, Maybe it's getting on the phone. Maybe it's walking precincts and knocking on doors. Maybe it's writing letters. You know, for each person, it's different. And one of the challenges in the campaign was that if you called and you said, how can I help? They said, you know, come in and phone bank. Well, that's nice, but if you only have an hour on a given day and you've got, you know, your dog to walk and your kids and your partners at work, so you can't do it. So a lot of people felt very disenfranchised and cut off. So what we decided to do was to try to Obamify and bring together what we knew from the technology industry, which is something called BarCamp. So BarCamp is this concept of taking a group of smart people, putting them in a room for a day, and putting a problem or an issue in front of them. No speakers, no schedules, kind of an unconference, this idea of just put people in a room and let the people in the room figure out what they want the day to look like and how they want to address the problem. So we decided to do a bar camp for marriage equality, and we called it Equality Camp. And so Equality Camp, the first one happened on January 3rd. We had about 95 people for a day. Two-thirds of them were not from the GLBT community. They were straight allies who had been frustrated at their disenfranchisement in this campaign, that their friends and their loved ones were cut off and now could not get married. And what we found through this process and through coming together was that there were a lot of people who wanted to create a website at which people and all of the organizations could register their group, we could share events, we could share resources. Again, think My Barack Obama, right? So think of all of the things that the Obama campaign did. And so working with a group in Southern California, we pooled our resources and created something called EqualityCentral.org. I urge all of you to please check it out. If you have a grassroots group, which could be you and a friend, it could be you and 50 people, it could be you and 500 people, doesn't matter. You can register your group for free. You can post your events. You can see what other events are happening. You can share resources, ask questions, forums. You know, you can find, you say, oh, well, we're doing this project. You find another group might be doing the same project. So instead of reinventing the wheel, you can all band together. And it's a slow go. It's a slow go because, let's face it, traditionally, the LGBT community has not necessarily been all that unified under that rainbow umbrella. We're really good at smacking each other down.
Yeah.
And so trying to use technology to maybe equalize a little bit and play nicely in the sandbox.
Yeah. What I'm hearing from almost all of you is this tension between your personal beliefs and your desires as a human being, as an LGBT person. I don't want to make assumptions about anybody's orientation, but correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, in journalism, there's this notion of objectivity, that reporters, although we may have feelings and opinions, all of us do, we set those aside and we do our jobs as journalists and we try to have a firewall in some ways between those two parts of us. How did each of you navigate that within your own organization or publications? And I'm thinking, I'll go with you first, Sandeep, because you were, I think of all of you, I think you were the one who most explicitly said we weren't taking sides.
As an organization, we were not taking sides, but we were in a campaign that was talking about, you know, introducing the image of same-sex couples and same-sex marriage, and you can be sure we were not introducing images of couples who were bitterly fighting with each other and saying we shouldn't have gotten together in the first place and we're breaking up and you are not getting the china and thank God we are not married so I don't have to share my china with you.
That's my record.
But I think where it came up, I mean, for us, in that sense, as working with Let California Ring, it was an issue that we felt deeply about, you know, ballot measure aside, at any, you know, there happened to be an election happening and there was a ballot measure. At any other time, if they had come to us and said, we want to do a campaign introducing the issue of same-sex marriage in ethnic media, we would have been very interested in doing that because it's a topic that people assume is often not covered in Chinese or Spanish language media, and it often is not covered. And many of the editors and publishers who we approach, and when we had approached them, we had no idea who would want to run it or not. You know, there's this image that the audiences of these are socially conservative, and many of them are. But a lot of the publications were very, very anxious and happy to be able to have that conversation. You know, one of the South Asian papers, in fact, a publisher told us that it was the first time he'd seen the issue presented so well, and he was really happy that it was being done. He, of course, added that after they ran some of the ads of showing this couple, his wife came and said, well, so would you really want your son, our son, to marry another man. So there was, you know, it's not like everybody immediately saw the ads and it was taking like taking a magic pill and changing over. But I think for us, for many people who were involved, I mean, for myself as a gay man, I was always explicitly out as a gay man. That didn't mean that I couldn't, you know, be part of the panel when we did a panel with both yes and no sides from both sides of the issue. It was great to have that panel. You know, it was just, it just meant that when I was writing a story, it wasn't like I wasn't saying you should vote this way or that way. But if the need came up, I was explicit and open about my orientation.
Cynthia, what about you and your reporters? I mean, you, obviously they write for a LGBT publication. There's really not a lot of dispute about where, you know, what your editorial position is.
Right. I mean,
obviously you oppose Prop 8, but, you know, what about on a personal level? How did you and your reporters deal with that question of objectivity?
Well, we just tried to always talk to both sides, you know, the yes and the no side, and talk to people in the community and talk to straight allies. Use the editorial, you know, page every week to kind of vent on things as we saw them happen or not, and just kind of let it, you know, took it that way. We do write for the gay community. We're part of the gay community, and that is, you know, our overriding mission is to serve the community.
Was there an expectation on the part of either the campaign, the No on 8 campaign, or leaders within the LGBT community that you were going to do a certain kind of coverage? I mean, did you get phone calls or pressure
No.
to cover certain things?
No.
Should you have, do you think? I mean, how proactive was the media operation of the campaign?
Well, it wasn't proactive enough. I mean, It wasn't until early October when they released their internal poll numbers that everything kind of turned around and we did our big red alert headline, which I brought a copy. It doesn't really translate on the web, but this is what it looked like in the paper. And that's when
old school newspaper.
Yeah. And that's when it started, you know, they started getting more donors and donations. They only had, the week after this we did a cover story, they only had like 32,000 donors. I mean, that was just absolutely unbelievable.
What triggered that was their internal polling, or
they
was
did a conference call with LGBT media to release their internal poll numbers to say they were losing, and they had no money.
And I spoke this week to some of the leadership of the campaign, and they expressed, some of them, frustration that they were saying that all along, and that the LGBT media weren't reporting it. That there was a complacency, your word that you used earlier.
Well, there was a complacency, but then, like I said, they had these field polls would come out showing the no side was winning, and we'd always get a comment from Jeff or Kate or someone saying, you know, it's much closer than that, but they would never, like, go that extra step and say, you know, we're really in trouble here. That never happened until this October 7th or whatever phone call,
yeah.
Conference call.
Rex, what about you? What was your relationship with the campaign like? I mean, did you feel like they were calling you and giving you things, or were they hard to reach? Were they responsive? And we don't want to, you know, revisit that whole period, but I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, what was it like for you as a journalist to be doing your job during that period of time? He's thinking.
I mean, I had contact with the top of the campaign every 2 or 3 days by phone starting in September or something. So, I mean, I was well informed whether it was on or off the record. Cynthia is absolutely right that they didn't, it's not normal to release your internal poll numbers publicly. That was something that the campaign leadership did against the advice of the consultants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not a normal thing. But I mean, you know, as a matter of background or off the record, you know, Jeff Coors was telling me routinely that their internal numbers weren't matching what we were seeing from the PPI and the field poll numbers about, which was showing that, you know, Prop 8 was gonna go down to defeat. I guess your original question was something about the kind of the conflict between
the objectivity and the
You know, I think what made the difference for me in the end, I also write for the daily paper down in San Diego, which is where I live. It's called the Union Tribune. I noticed that all the gay reporters at the Union Tribune, and there's lots of them, have their blogs, and I noticed that they were starting to blog about Prop 8 and marriage. And I sort of asked some of them, I was like, does the paper have a policy about what you can say on your blog? And they were like, no, you just have to put a little disclaimer in the footers that says these are your opinions and not that of Copley Press, right? And so I really think that the internet has ushered in this era that's given reporters kind of and journalists another avenue to write and talk and have a voice. And I think there's conflict right now on exactly how far we can go if we're going to put our opinions out there. And, of course, you don't want to get confused and start putting your opinions in a news story for the news section of the newspaper. But there is, you know, the Sunday morning chat shows, as I mentioned, do this as well. They let reporters opinionize.
Although that makes a lot of people uncomfortable.
It does, indeed. And, you know, we people who work for Dead Tree Media, ultimately, we need to stay relevant. And if we don't move on to the web, we're not going to stay relevant. And when you move on to the web, the rules, I think, are a little bit different than what we learned in journalism school or what the AP still requires of people here.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to media coverage of Proposition 8 and its aftermath with Rex Wachner, LGBT journalist and blogger, Cynthia Laird, news editor for the Bay Area Reporter, Sandeep Roy, host of New America Now on KALW Public Radio, and Kathy Brooks of Equality Camp and founder of Other Than That Consulting. And by the way, when you came in, you found little cards that are on your chairs. Feel free to write down a question. We'll be taking those in just a few minutes. Kathy, you wanted to say something.
I just wanted to chime in on this idea of, to pick up on something that Rex said. I mean, I am a classically trained journalist. I mean, I went to print journalism school. I learned to, lay out newspaper like when you actually did the layout of the typesetting and writing headlines and, writing with pencils back when we walked uphill to school both ways in the snow barefoot and used an abacus for math. The internet is democratizing everything. And when it comes to media moving into this world of the web and with all of the social media platforms, as long as you are transparent, you'll hear the words transparent and authentic are bandied about pretty often. And, to Rex's point that for media people who are, operating on multiple platforms, as long as you're able to separate kind of the what is your personal opinion from what are you doing, and you're able to keep the line clean, and what I was seeing through the course of the campaign was precisely what Rex is talking about, where when your opinion, really drives, toward where the public is looking, that it becomes the media's almost responsibility to take part in that conversation.
The idea of transparency is interesting, and I wonder how far each of you think that should go. In other words, what do you disclose? Personally, my partner and I got married back when it was, a protest, I guess you'd call it, in 2004, and that caused a bit of a dust up at KQED, which I can talk about if anyone wants to hear about it. And in the end, I ended up just disclosing that on the air when it was appropriate once or twice. But to what extent do you all feel that you need to disclose anything personal about you, about your partner, if your partner's on the board of some organization or is a volunteer or whatever? I mean, Rex?
Yeah, I can answer that one. If I'm writing a news story, it has to go in parentheses at the end of the story. I live with my housemate is an ex-partner of mine who happens to be the chair of the county Democratic Party. So sometimes it's just absolutely impossible to avoid him finding his way into some news story I'm writing locally in San Diego. If it's a news story, even if I'm blogging, actually, it's got to go in parentheses down at the end. I think that's you need to be upfront about any perception that someone may have that you're slanting something one way or the other because of this, that, or the other thing. You need to make that clear.
So when in doubt, disclose.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cynthia, what about you?
Yeah, I would agree. And my partner is involved in the community here, and I don't write about her, but when the paper does write about her, we disclose that. She ran for judge last year in Alameda County, so I didn't cover any of that, and we disclose that in the stories also. So I agree with Rex.
Sandeep?
I tend not to write at the bottom of my stories. I mean, I write something like Sandeep Roy is a gay, but but
and you are not.
But I did a call-in show after Prop 8, and it was kind of talking to people on both sides of the issue on what went down. And in that case, I actually did feel compelled to say on the air, you know, that I was gay, because I did not, the person who was from the Yes on 8 side, one of the main organizers, was on the show, and I didn't want him to feel like I was hiding something and, you know, in effect, siding with the other person on the show, so I was quite upfront with him on the air. Yeah.
This question goes back to, in a way, this idea of balance, but it's really more than that, and I attended, for my show, KQED, and the California Report, I went to a Yes on 8 rally in Sacramento, and I forget the date, but it was sometime in October, I think. Massive turnout, huge numbers of people, very fervent crowd, and it was impressive. I'm wondering the extent to which any of you did that in your coverage or in the work that you do. Kathy?
So we had a very interesting experience at Equality Camp. About halfway through the morning, a group of tall African-American gentlemen, tall, like 6 foot plus, walked in, one of whom was wearing a priest collar. He is a very right-leaning Yes on 8 supporter from Prunedale, and he and his ministry have decided that anytime there's something within a three-hour drive of their ministry, they go. And we engaged in about a 45-minute to an hour-long conversation, and what that showed me, and I had done this previously as well, is that, you know, it's like, what's the line from The Godfather? Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. I think that until we try to start understanding the other side, as much as we may find them, you know, we may find them as abhorrent as they find, you know, us, but until there is some at least attempt to try to speak civilly with the other side, understanding that there will always be some people whose minds will never change.
But part of it is also understanding the organization and the strength and the determination.
And every Sunday they have a meeting.
Yeah.
Every Sunday morning most of them, you know, go to their meeting in their church.
Yeah. Cynthia, to what extent do you think the complacency that you mentioned was in part because LGBT media wasn't really covering what the other side was doing in a systematic or, you know, consistent way?
Well, I think we did try to do that. I did have a reporter up at that rally in Sacramento, that news conference that you were probably at, specifically because I wanted photos of those people to run in our paper so that our readers could know what, you know, these, what they look like and what they were saying. But I think part of the problem was, you know, they wouldn't always call us back. They didn't want to talk to the gay press. And I think that's, you know, short-sighted on their part. But
is that enough, though, to say they won't call us back?
Well, if they don't call us back, they don't call us back. You know, we tried to call. We always tried to call.
Yeah.
I was going to add, you know, I remember when we did the debate between yes and no sides, and it was sometime in October, we actually got a lot more response from on the call back side from the yes on 8 side than the no on 8, to be honest. It was a debate for ethnic media. And in terms of the objectivity, we actually, you know, because we wanted somebody who was Asian, somebody who was African American, somebody who was Latino on each side of the issue, and we spent some time really looking for good speakers on both sides. There were several people who called, say, on, you know, who were possible speakers on the Yes on 8 side, and we listened to them and realized they just sounded kind of crazy, and you know, we could have put somebody like that out there, you know, it would have made the other side sound much more reasoned and much better, but it would have made a less interesting conversation. It would have been easier to breed that sense of complacency that we've been talking about, where you feel like, oh, this person is sounding so crazy that nobody's possibly going to believe them. So we wanted actually people who were very reasoned and thought out.
Do you think because you were not a specifically LGBT or identified media outlet that they were more open to you?
I think they were more open to us because they felt that the audiences that we were reaching, namely African American and Latino Asians, would be open to their message. And they made a very, very concerted effort to reach out to these media. You know, as I mentioned, all these media were getting ad solicitations from the Yes on 8 side throughout.
Yeah. Rex, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I think in the gay press, we have an obligation to try to wade into the other side to the extent that they'll let us in. I managed to get credentialed for, and last November 8th attended something called The Call, which was tens of thousands of fundamentalist Christians in the football stadium in San Diego. It was a national thing with Lou Dobson and Tony Perkins. And, I mean, I was very upfront with them about who I write for and just proceeded on the assumption that they had an obligation to give me a credential like anybody else, and they did. And, you know, it was a 16-hour event. It was basically an anti-gay marriage revival, you know. And I went in there, and I didn't...
Did that change the way you felt about the likelihood of Prop 8 being defeated?
It did not, but what was surprising to me was to kind of be kind of in the belly of the beast for 16 hours, and I had expected to feel more hatred or something, and I didn't really feel that. These were people who fervently believed what they believed, and I'm not sure that a lot of them, I don't necessarily think that a lot of them were lying when they said, we love you, and we just want you to, you know, see the light or whatever. And so it was kind of eye-opening. I was expecting, you know, more rabidness, I think, than what I saw, and I didn't see that at all. Well, and I put that in my story, you know, and I got criticized by gay people for not being mean enough to them when I covered it.
Well, and there was a sophistication to the Yes campaign in that when you would talk with them, at least with the hires up in the campaign, they were very clear, we're not against gay relationships, we're not even against necessarily civil unions, you know, that it was really about marriage. Now, since then, of course, they've, you know, going after the marriages, which they said they wouldn't do. I mean, there's a slightly different tack being taken, but...
I was going to add to that, you know, one of the things that came up so late in the campaign was the issue of children, and, you know, that was the ad that ran on television. And I remember... earlier on in the campaign when we were looking at the couples that we wanted to portray in these ads, you know, there were so many consultants and so many focus groups associated with that, but the net result of it was that they specifically did not want ads with children in them.
You're talking about the leadership of the No on 8 campaign?
It was, you know, I don't know if it was the No on 8 or the Let California Ring, but basically, you know, we were at the receiving end of, we were trying to find these couples for the media campaign, and we were told basically we don't want ads with children in it because it raises too many questions. And in hindsight, looking back, it also left people vulnerable to, you know, when the issue of children came up at the end of the campaign. You know, it was suddenly, there were no images of children to counter some of the stories being put out by the Yes on 8 side. I mean, there was also an issue around interracial couples. People did not want to see interracial couples in the ads. But it leads to this thing where, you know, on the No on 8 side, there was such nervousness about the kind of image that needed to be put forward. So it had to be this kind of really idealized milquetoast thing that couldn't possibly offend anybody. In a way, maybe we gave people less credibility than was due, you know, that they could actually deal with real people.
Yeah. Let me take some questions from the audience here. One of them is, Hispanic, Asian, and Black majorities voted yes. Not sure that's true, actually. I think Asians may not have. And Latinos were pretty split, but and Blacks actually were not as widely in support as that exit poll was. Nonetheless, how do we turn these constituencies around? Whites voted no by a majority. I don't know if that's true either, but anyway, setting all that aside, there's a lot of work to be done, I think everyone would agree, with communities of color. I think that's really the gist of the question. What needs to happen?
I think it's work that needs to be done by LGBT activists who are members of those groups or minority groups or communities. And so to the extent that those of us who aren't members of those communities or minority groups, we need to empower and fund the people who are so that they can do the work inside their own communities. I think that's the most important, the best way to go at that.
Kathy?
There's an event that's put together by the Courage folks at the Courage Campaign called Camp Courage.
Just tell people what the Courage
Campaign is. So the Courage Campaign is a progressive political organization. It is not LGBT specific, though marriage equality is one of the main issues that they are pushing forward right now. And they put something together called Camp Courage, which is modeled on Camp Obama, which is the two-day training camp that every field volunteer, field organizer for the Obama campaign was required to go through, and it's based on training that the Farm Workers Union has used. Cleve Jones was there. It's what the Civil Rights Movement has used, and it's this idea of in order to move communities, you need to go into those communities and tell your stories and engage on a person-to-person basis. At this event, I met a number of people from many of these minority communities, from Black community, the Asian community, Hispanic community, and all of them said, we weren't called upon. We weren't called upon during the campaign. We would have helped you if you had asked, but so we're here now. And so I agree that members of those communities certainly need to go into those communities, but I think it also needs to be not just LGBT people in those communities, but really reaching across the aisle, so to speak, and remember that the only way to really move hearts and minds is to realize that it's not just within the LGBT community. It's reaching out to the numbers that are far greater. Let's face it, if you do, just sheer numbers, there are probably more straight people in the world than there are.
There was some anger directed at the Obama campaign and Barack Obama himself after the election because the Yes on 8 campaign used his words about his opposition to gay marriage. The No campaign, I suppose, could have used his words saying he was against Prop 8 but didn't. Was that fair, do you think, to be critical? I mean, there was a lot of anger, obviously, and disappointment. Is there more the Obama campaign could have done, should have done, or was that just not their fight? They didn't have a dog in that fight.
Well, I mean, I think to their credit, they had a couple of big fish that they were frying at the time. Kind of like, why doesn't Obama make LGBT issues a top issue for him, for the administration right now? I think there are a couple of other issues that, I'm okay with him dealing with the economy first, personally. Wars overseas and all of that sort of stuff. What the Yes on 8 campaign did was actually inaccurately represent what Obama said. And they did it masterfully. I mean, they ran a masterful messaging campaign and they outplayed us.
What did they say that was incorrect?
They paraphrased his quote. So the wording that they took out was not actually the entire quote. For people who I know who actually worked very closely in the campaign, his personal beliefs and what he has said publicly are not exactly the same.
Yeah. Rex?
The problem with Barack Obama and same-sex marriage is that he's schizophrenic about it himself. He clearly went before the Saddleback Church and said, marriage is between a man and a woman, and that's my belief. He also clearly came out in opposition to Proposition 8. Which is it? Should we be allowed to get married or not?
And the key members of the No on 8 campaign were in the room at the Alice breakfast on Pride Sunday when they read the letter from Obama saying he was against Proposition 8, and they never used that. And they should have used that. Should have used it no matter what the Obama campaign would have told them.
I was a little taken aback in the week after the election, or the week of the election, actually, some of the anger that was expressed to me on the phone by some of the leadership of the No on 8 campaign toward the Obama campaign. And it was suddenly, after all, the exit polls, there was suddenly this revelation that, we didn't really do outreach to communities of color. And I'm wondering, Cynthia, if you think, is there a blind spot in general within LGBT media for coverage and visibility for issues, not just of LGBT people of color, but those issues affecting, whether it's poverty, racism, discrimination, you name it, things that may not necessarily be part of the coverage of say, the BAR?
Well, no, I don't really think so. I know that we try to do a lot of coverage of gays of color in different communities all the time. We've done that with AIDS, with marriage. We've done biracial couples. We've done immigration issues, binational couples, pretty regularly. So I think there was a blind spot on the part of the No on 8 campaign that, with this top-down style that they adopted, didn't really reach out. I ran into an African-American woman up at the campaign headquarters less than a week before the election, and they had just called her.
Sandeep, what's your perspective on all that?
I remember soon after the elections, Jasmine Kanick, who writes is a blogger in Los Angeles, African-American, and she wrote about this issue, and she wrote a piece that was circulated widely where she criticized people for, A, not reaching out, not knowing how to reach out, and not thinking also is, you know, is very often, I think, with communities of color, what happens is somebody else decides what the issue is and then, you know, and then presents it as fully formed, and your job is then to, if you call, like somebody mentioned before, is, okay, you can come and volunteer at the phone bank, as opposed to finding out, like, how do you go about it? And that was why when we worked on this campaign, it was never a question of, like, okay, we'll do some ads, we'll do some photo shoots, and then you run the, you know, translate the ads into four different languages and then run it in all the media. Our job was actually to get the editors and publishers of the media together in a round table, do three round tables in LA, Fresno, and San Francisco, and ask them how they thought the issue should be covered. You know, let them control the messaging in a way that worked for their communities. And from that, it came out a lot was there for them. The key thing was to talk about families, and they wanted to see this, the couples in a family setting, because that was what they felt resonated most strongly with the campaign. And so I guess it's a simple thing of, like, asking people.
You know, there was a press conference in San Francisco in the Mission, again, it was probably in October, with Latino community leaders. And there were some very powerful messages given by LGBT people there about this, whether or not you're gay. This may not be about you, but it's about your cousin who's gay, or your nephew who's gay, your grandson. And it was a very powerful message. And I didn't really hear that at all during the campaign. Did I miss it, or was it just, was that just not part of what they were saying?
The family, you mean bringing up
the family,
family,
yeah.
I didn't.
I didn't hear a lot of it, and I mean, I did see that in, you know, in the coverage that the media did, in the ethnic media. Like, for example, you know, we had a picture of, say, two Chinese women who had, who were in a marriage ceremony together. That was picked up not just by the Chinese media, but by Filipino media and these media who were very anxious for these images of people who looked like them. And you know, La Opinion, the biggest circulating Spanish language daily, issued an editorial saying, asking people to vote no on Prop 8, which is, you know, what's fairly unusual for them.
Here's another audience question. Much blame is placed on the campaign. How did you see your role in scrutinizing the campaign before October, and how has it affected the way you will cover future campaigns? Cynthia?
Well, I don't think we scrutinized it enough before October, quite frankly, and that is certainly something that I will not let happen should we go forward with another ballot fight. I think we should have listened in on the calls and been up there and gotten the phone scripts and reported on that so that people could see well in advance of the October red alert thing that these scripts were, no one liked them, no one wanted to read them, they couldn't read anything else, so no one was going to phone bank.
Why do you think you didn't do all those things that you would do now?
I don't know.
Rex?
Yeah, I started blogging about the deficiencies of the No on 8 campaign, I think sometime in late September. And I think I was one of the most aggressive voices in doing that. And even so, I was constantly worried that I was going to put something on my blog and Andrew Sullivan was going to link to it and it was going to go viral. And that I would somehow, you know, damage the campaign by criticizing it. And so I would, those blog posts would go through like seven or eight drafts, and each one would water down the previous one. You know, the crux of the criticism was still there, but I was constantly worried that I was going to do something that would make it all worse, you know. And so that was the kind of conflict that even after I made the decision to kind of be a voice for the people who, in their responses to my mailing list, and these are people that you've heard of, I mean, not just random people, that were criticizing the campaign privately to me, I made the decision to kind of be their voice and kind of blog, you know, the deficiencies that we all were seeing in the No on 8 campaign. But I was worried that I was going to, you know, it wasn't that I was afraid I was going to get blamed, but I mean, I just didn't really want that karma hanging over my head that something I wrote made it all worse and made it more likely that we would lose it.
I'm curious what you think each... What impact do you think your respective efforts had, one way or the other, either on the community or the campaign, public opinion? Do you feel, for example, your blog made a difference, and what was the difference it made?
People were afraid to put themselves on the line for the same reason that I was afraid. They were afraid that if we kind of take our our intra-community dirty laundry public in October, you know, before November 4th, and start just spewing all that out there onto the web, that it might just give ammunition to the Yes on Eight people. It might help them in some way. So people were very hesitant to criticize Jeff Koors or Steve Smith or Kate Kendall or Lori Jean and say, you know, what the hell's going on? Why are these ads so bad? You know, why are these scripts so controlled that people feel, these phone banking scripts that people feel, you know, they can't even express themselves in a way that's useful?
People found their voice after the campaign, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, it really would have been useful. I mean, you know, the No on Eight Executive Committee has admitted that they handed this stuff all off to consultants and that they didn't really pay attention after that. They hired the best and the brightest consultants. They said, here, you handle this. And then they went on to do other things like raise money and be concerned with other aspects of running, you know, that very complicated campaign. And at the point that it became apparent that the consultants were probably not handling it in the best way, if there had been more noise from your editorial page and from me and just from everybody who could see this was happening, it might have provoked Jeff and Lori and Kate and to pay more attention to what the consultants were doing and maybe get in there and do something about it at an earlier time. But everybody was afraid.
Sandeep, what about you, this question of impact?
I think it definitely had an impact because it created a conversation in a place where there wasn't very much conversation happening in many of these media spaces. I think one of the issues is, as Rex was bringing up in terms of consultant, it's sometimes there is no one-size-fits-all solution for this. You know, this is an incredibly complicated minority-majority state, and you're going to have to figure out how to talk about these issues in different ways to different communities of people. And I think with consultants, you do often want to, like, plane things out and level out the rough edges and try and bring up the one perfect thing. I mean, I still remember somebody telling me, a friend of mine that who is Asian, and his friend who is heterosexual is not married, and told his mother, and his parents, you know, his parents were bugging him to get married, and he tells his mother something like, well, you know, at least I'm not gay. And she turns to him and says, well, I wish you were gay with children. You know, there's lots of gay people with children. And, but that was her primary goal, to have granted. So, you know, it's like at some level, I think the impact is to know that people are ready to have these real conversations and not be so afraid to bring up things like children or the fact that our lives are complicated.
Kathy? Yeah.
Just a very quick comment that may get me hit by somebody here, so don't hit me. But in a way, I almost feel like we had to lose in November because of all of these things about holding these organizations like NCLR and Equality California and HRC, all these organizations that have been for so long the kind of the torchbearers for the community. We've bequeathed a lot to them over the years. And I'm not saying that that's good or that's bad. It's just the way that it was. And now this holding people accountable and using our voices and saying when we, you know, you said you won't cover a campaign the same way again, and we'll use our voices in different ways. And as a community, I'm seeing a cohesion that didn't happen before. Now, the rose-colored glasses were smacked off my head a long time ago. I don't hold any illusion that we're all going to be singing a big kumbaya under the rainbow flag anytime soon. But I do think that in terms of moving forward as a community, in a strange, almost backhanded way, that this may, years from now, when we've won the right for marriage and all of these other things, we will look back on this as a time that was very important for us to happen this way.
You know, if you look at the recent history, I think there have been about 33 ballot measures in different states on marriage, and they've all, you know, depending, won or lost. I mean, gay marriage has never won on the ballot. The people who ran the campaign and others say, you know, if you look at Prop 8, yeah, it won, but it was close, much closer, say, than the Knight Initiative was in 2000. Is that valid, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, what was it? 2000, it was what, 22% was the delta between the win and the loss?
Yeah, it was like 22%, 62, I think. Yeah.
And now we're looking at a 4% margin in a very brief period of time. I mean, the tide is changing. I mean, we have to remember, think about the civil rights movement. You know, in the civil rights movement, when the right, the privilege was granted, that's with air quotation marks for people who might be listening, for people of color to sit in the front of the bus, the movement didn't end. The movement was really just beginning. There were hearts and minds to win and many other rights and privileges. Marriage is just the beginning. I mean, we have so many other rights. What is it, federal rights? One, like more than how many?
1,500.
1,500, something like that, or 1,300, something like that. There's a lot of work to do.
But at the same, you know, while I take heart at the fact that the margin was fairly close, I also get worried about the same issue of complacency. Sometimes when I hear a lot of people saying, you know, that young people are overwhelmingly voted no, and so it's just a matter of time.
More people need to die.
Then it feels like you just sit around and wait, and then 10. And I'm not sure it always. I mean, I think you can breed some of the same complacency that was at work in this campaign.
Cynthia?
The problem I have with that is that out of these 30-odd states where we've lost, no one's learned any lessons from that to carry forward into the fight for Prop 8 here in California. I mean, we had HRC send staff here. We had the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force send staff here. They were on the ground in all those other states, too. Didn't they learn anything? It was the same campaign. It was the same campaign as the Knight Initiative, with no families, no gays in the commercials. No, they had a lesbian commercial. They never aired it.
Rex?
I have to agree. I mean, it's all the more frustrating because it was so close. We needed to flip, you know, a little over 2% of the people who voted, and that works out to 600,000 some voters, to have won it. If the TV ads had not been so, you know, hopelessly neutered, if the scripting for the phone banking had not been so incredibly uninteresting, if there had been, you know, any minimal attempt to somehow get the message into, for example, black churches or something, eight could have gone down to defeat. I mean, it was that close. And so when you look at the sum total of all the mistakes that were made by the campaign, it was more than enough to flip 2.5% of the vote. And that's what's really frustrating about it. And Cynthia's absolutely right. The playbook that they used is the same darn playbook, word for word, that failed 30 other times in 30 other states. Why did we try the same thing again?
Hmm. We're really short on time. Let me see if I can sneak another question in here. How can we democratize Equality California and the next ballot proposition campaign? Who wants to tackle that one? And is that a good idea? Can you run a campaign democratically? I mean, is that really a good idea? There was a report issued, I think, today or yesterday.
Yesterday, yes.
About the campaign. It was done for Equality California. And one of their recommendations is, sure, open the campaign up and do more grassroots stuff, but you've got to have a very small group of people, 3 to 5 people max, making the decisions.
I saw that, and I think that report has some really interesting things in it, and it is on their website, so everyone can read it. And it really does offer kind of a blueprint going forward in that you can involve the grassroots, but it's all about, and you don't have to control them, is what the report says. You can focus them and channel them, and that's exactly what needs to happen. But yes, a campaign is different. It's for a specific amount of time. Your election day is your end point, and it needs to be really focused. Yes on 8 was really focused. They never wavered from their message. They were all on the same page all the time, and they just went with it.
Kathy?
So I agree with everything that Cynthia just said, and I think that technology and kind of using the Obama example, you know, let's make no mistake, even though there were grassroots and people were empowered, it was a very top-down run campaign with a very structured organization, a very centralized beast, and they blended it using the internet and kind of empowering the field, doing it that way. What I am heartened to see are some of the new organizations like Marriage Equality USA and some of these others that have arisen in the last 6-7 months, or longer, I guess, at this point, that I see now as the standard bearers moving forward. Then, you know, NCLR, Equality California will all still be involved doing the legal stuff that they know how to do, but let this other organization go with people who, you know, are playing nicely in the sandbox with it.
All right. Well, this conversation is not over, but we have to end it for now. Thanks to all of you for coming, and thanks to our panel. How about a hand for them? And with that, I will hand it back to Lori, along with the microphone.
Our thanks to Rex Wachner, journalist and blogger, Cynthia Laird, news editor, Bay Area reporter, Sandeep Roy, host, New America Now, Kathy Brooks, activist with Equality Camp, thanking all of them for their comments here today. I'd also like to thank Scott Schaefer, host of KQED's Radio California Report, for moderating the event. We also thank our audiences here as well as our radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.